Good afternoon. I'm Jeff Beckwith, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Municipal Association, and it's our pleasure to serve as the platform host for the Baker-Polito administration's weekly update to municipal chief executive officers regarding the COVID-19 pandemic and all of the steps that the state is taking to work with you to coordinate a response that protects the people of the Commonwealth. Well, I'll turn it right over to the main attraction for these briefings, Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito, who's been a terrific partner with all of you trying to provide real-time information, massive amounts of it to all of you so that you can collaborate, cooperate, and work to protect the safety of the people of Massachusetts. Lieutenant Governor, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you once again for coming together for this hour to share important concerns and ideas that you have with us, and we can also share some information with you so you're up to speed. I just want to say again how grateful we are for your leadership locally during these difficult times, both managing the reopening process, fighting the spread of the virus, and addressing concerns that citizens have around racial inequities. There's a lot on everybody's plates. So thank you. Keep up your great work. It is a team effort, and we need to support each other in this process. So we have Catherine Hornby, who's on. She will be able to give us an update on the CARES Act and address some of the funding issues around the federal support that we're receiving. DLS Senior Deputy Commissioner Sean Cronin is also on the call, and Dr. Larry Madoff has returned to the call. I want to just sort of put in perspective where we are in terms of the phased reopening. I feel grateful that we have this phased, careful approach to opening, as well as the systematic process of working with industries, working with you as municipalities to make sure workplaces are opening with the safety measures in place. And at the same time, everyone is doing their part. I continue to be inspired by the willingness of the citizens of our Commonwealth to do what they need to do as they do move about more so, but adhere to the recommendations from our public health officials around facial coverings, distancing, hand sanitization. It's just become a part of our lives, and people are really honoring that and being so respectful to others. So we appreciate that. I do want to talk about the testing program that we have set up for this week at the end of my remarks and before heading it over to our Catherine Hornby. We have a couple of grants that I think are pretty good. Obviously, being in the first part of phase two, we allowed for outdoor dining to take place. And thanks to your creativity, the hard work of your local departments, you've been able to work with a lot of businesses to expand or create new opportunities for outdoor dining. I had the chance to dine out with my family last week, and it was in a parking lot in the back of the building, and they put planters up, and there were about 50 people spaced apart, and it was wonderful. It was a beautiful night. Everyone really enjoyed it, and I think people are getting into the, are feeling more comfortable about dining out because of these outdoor offerings. So we have worked with our team over at MassDOT to put together $5 million in grant funds that'll be directly available to municipalities. It's called the Shared Streets and Spaces Emergency Grant Program. And it's designed with the idea that you're challenged with looking at spaces like sidewalks, parking lots, and roadways and streetways that you are looking to convert into a different use. And these funds will be available to assist you. It's a $5 million program. The program details are on the website, and applications will be available June 22nd. It's a rolling process, so they want to be expeditious about processing your request and get these funds over to you. The grants will be as small as $5,000 or up to $300,000 in the event that you have like a set of streets or an area that you want to establish as a dining venue. You would be able to use these funds to supplement your efforts locally to make some of these sidewalks, streets, parking areas into interesting places for people to enjoy. The Bar Foundation is also partnered with us on this. They are available for technical assistance to help communities fill out their application, to also strategizing with you around how to solve accessibility issues that may be associated with using spaces that need to sort of coexist with travelers and people with different abilities. So that is also available to you. I hope you take advantage of that and continue to do a great work working with our small businesses and restaurants that are opening. On the food theme, we also announced a $36 million food security infrastructure grant program. I want to thank members of the legislature who worked hard on this, as well as members of our team and you, to think about how to source local foods, fresh foods, and be able to create a supply chain that will allow these foods to be available to people in need through our food banks across our Commonwealth. During this emergency, we were able to set up a system of food supply and delivery that was very effective. And now we want to see more of this happen, where we can combine the richness of our resources here to a supply chain that can get to the people who need help in our communities. And the infrastructure dollars will help businesses think about how they might package foods, process foods in a way that, for instance, a nonprofit like a food bank might need in order to repackage it, put it into a food box, and then present it to an end user. So these funds are available to farmers, fishermen, food processors, and it's all about quality, fresh, local, healthy food being available to everyone across our Commonwealth. Applications are open, and this will also be on an expedited basis. The rolling basis process is through September 15th. And funds are anticipated to be awarded in amounts up to $500,000. So just wanted to pass that on to you as well. And then we obviously know that there have been a number of large gatherings over the past couple of weeks. And we wanted to continue to be vigilant around fighting the spread of the virus, knowing so many people have done a lot to sacrifice and do their own part to not only take care of themselves, but to not be presenting a risk to someone else. And as these gatherings emerged over these last few weeks, there were a lot of people that were coming together in demonstration. And what we observed in some instances, people were wearing their face coverings and being respectful that way. And in other circumstances, it was not as strict as that. And so we just wanted to have an opportunity to make testing available free at 50 pop-up sites. There's a website that has these locations. Some of them you can show up at, and some of them you would need an appointment at, but you can get a test. The test results will be provided to each participant confidentially, but it would certainly provide information to individuals around quarantine and isolation and protecting themselves and others as we continue to reopen in the Commonwealth in these upcoming weeks. Our numbers look good. You know, they really reflect a lot of hard work and discipline and attention by many, many people across our Commonwealth, including the businesses that are reopening in a safer way. And we want to just continue to acknowledge that, but but also use the testing as a way to just verify and determine if there is spread so that we can address that. We certainly don't want to go backwards after all of this effort and sacrifice and hard work on your parts. So we thought that the 2 days of testing, June 17th and June 18th of this week, would provide another resource and data collection effort to help continue to inform us as we manage through these upcoming phases. In terms of the next section of phase two, which could include things like close personal contacts, could include indoor dining with the restrictions, could potentially open early next week. We need to continue to look at the data like we did right before the beginning of phase two and see that the data is supporting our understanding that it would be safe to reopen more activities. We're also looking at office capacity. That has been a question that many have asked of us. When will we increase beyond 25%? We are looking at that as well, and we'll be able to provide more information for the end of the week or over the weekend regarding the next phase of phase two, which could begin early next week. Hopefully everything is going to continue to trend in the right direction. With that, I'm just going to turn it over to Catherine, and I look forward to addressing some of the questions in the chat.
Great, thank you. Thank you to the Lieutenant Governor and to Jeff and the entire Mass Municipal Association team. So I wanted to speak primarily to the Coronavirus Relief Fund, which is, as you know, a large component part of the Federal CARES Act that was passed in March, how that program is going, and in particular, the municipal piece of it. So just to recap the application process, we made funds available to the cities and towns bounded in the first instance by the federal laws around the program. So that's three primary restrictions. One is that it has to be COVID-related necessary expenditures, so expenditures, not revenue replacement. The second requirement is that the cost be incurred between March 1st and December 30th. The third is that they be unbudgeted as of March 27th. So the approach that we have taken, as you know, is to announce the availability of approximately $500 million in funding to the city for the cities and towns that we are running in two rounds. So that's the application process that's just wrapping up now for FY20, and then we anticipate running a second round in FY21, probably in the early fall. Essentially, there's a little bit of crossover, though, in that municipalities who did not request funds for FY20 are still free to do so during the FY21 round. So if you have not applied, you have not missed your opportunity, but we did want to make the opportunity available for municipalities to get FY20 money sort of as soon as is reasonably possible. The strategy, as we outlined on prior webcasts, was to try to maximize the amount of federal funds that are on the table for the state and for the cities and towns, and in particular to say that where costs are eligible for FEMA reimbursement, to ask that municipalities look for FEMA reimbursement first, conceptually in terms of how those costs stack up. So state their intent to apply to FEMA for reimbursement for any costs that appear to be reimbursable, and then use the coronavirus money as the 25% match, and also to cover costs that are not eligible under FEMA for any of a number of reasons. We distributed allowable amounts as primarily as a guide so that we would have a shared, you know, sort of clear and shared expectations about the amount of money that the state was making available in 20 and in 21. I would say that we have always anticipated that if the federal rules changed around this program, that we would revisit that and the allowable amounts that we distributed. We have also always anticipated that some communities may end up having extraordinary needs based on local circumstances. So for example, we hope this is not the case, obviously, but if there were to be a second outbreak in the fall and it turns out that it's sort of concentrated in certain areas of the state, I think we would reasonably assume that there may be additional and at this point unanticipated costs. We want to maintain the flexibility to be responsive to extraordinary circumstances and local needs, and are happy to engage with communities and to continue to engage with communities as circumstances evolve. So applications were due last Friday. We have received applications from almost 80% of the 323 municipalities that were eligible to apply. Plymouth County, as you know, is running a separate process, and Boston also applied for its funds directly from the federal government. So 323 is 351 minus the Plymouth and Boston towns or cities. As I said, applications have been received by the large majority of those municipalities and has been distributed to more than half of the applicant municipalities. The remainder are under review, generally for relatively small issues. So I would say a one thing that we ran into repeatedly is where the total request and the amount that was certified in our certification form around making sure that these federal rules and recoupment rules would be followed. Sometimes there were inconsistencies between the total request and the certified request, so it wasn't always 100% clear to us how much money was being requested. We needed to clear that up. We're also following up with municipalities who requested the full drawdown of funds in FY20. This is permissible, but we just wanted to make sure that we were all on the same page, that if municipalities have drawn down the full amount in 20, the expectation is that that's spanning 2 years for them, the FY20 and FY21 costs. So we are in the process of following up, but as I said, more than half of the applicant municipalities should already have their cash in hand. I wanted to mention just a few what I see as kind of boundary issues that came up repeatedly in terms of questions that we were asked. One is a number of municipalities asked whether revenue replacement was allowed. Sometimes as a general question, there has always been hope that the federal government would change its view. Has that happened? The answer is no, not yet, but we maintain hope. Or sometimes more specific questions that I would say most typically around the school meals programs, where with schools closed, there was less, the revenue associated with school meals was not coming in. Was that a permissible expense to cover? And unfortunately, the answer is no, because of the federal restrictions. Another boundary question was there were a handful of municipalities who asked about essentially long-term capital investments, and we've said no to those because the scale of those, if we started doing essentially long-term capital investments with these funds, we would essentially kind of quickly exhaust the resources of the program. Where requests came in for things like plexiglass, things like furniture, things to kind of reconfigure interior spaces, we were supportive of those. But where the requests went beyond that into essentially a kind of office renovation type requests, we said no. Third, I would say boundary issue was there were some requests for expenses where there are other more targeted revenue sources available through other parts of the CARES Act. And so we have generally sort of deferred those requests to the more targeted funding sources. So I wanted to speak briefly on a few next steps. And I think first and foremost is schools. I think that one of the pattern of questions that we got as municipalities were thinking about how much money to apply for through this program was, what about schools with reopening costs in the fall? Sort of how should they be thinking about schools? There's some special issues that apply to regional schools because of the sort of the nature of the decision making for regional schools and how that flows through to local budgets. There is money that's available specifically for schools, primarily through the ESSER grants that DESE is administering. ESSER grants are patterned essentially on Title I, and so more is available to cities and towns with higher concentration of poor students. But nonetheless, these ESSER grants are available. And so we've deferred some of mostly the school costs to these DESE programs. I would say that I think it's pretty clear that the discussion about how schools will reopen in the fall and what exactly are the requirements and what are the costs and therefore the revenue implications of that is something that we are working very closely with EOE and with DESE on. And we are thinking about, just jointly with EOE and with DESE, about what's the best way to try to map out what are the likely costs, what are the available revenue sources, and sort of how do we make that program kind of come together for the cities and towns. So I think one thing one change you may see when we do the second round of this in FY21, in the fall of 21, is a more direct addressing of the question about how to finance new school costs. So stay tuned on that, please. Elsewhere in the next steps world, the federal context, it continues to be a little bit of an unknown in that, as you know, we've had now multiple rounds of federal support, which have been material to the Commonwealth. So this coronavirus relief fund alone has been worth about $2.5 billion. There is, nonetheless, talk of further federal legislation. And in fact, there was a big bill called the HEROES Act that cleared the House of Representatives that would imply something on the order of $12 to $14 billion for the state of Massachusetts across a couple of different formula-based programs, plus about $7 billion for municipalities and counties. So that bill is, I mean, where you consider that the coronavirus relief fund involved $2.5 billion, the idea that between the state and the cities and towns, there could be as much as another $19 billion is obviously a sort of a huge second round of funds. The Senate, Republicans in particular, I would say, have taken a dim view of the HEROES Act, and the administration, the federal administration, has also said that that bill is much too big. But they have also indicated that they are likely to take up a smaller bill, maybe in July. So I think when we think that on the House side, if there's, again, $12 to $14 billion for the state and $7 billion for the municipalities, we're likely to get only a fraction of those numbers. But a fraction of fairly big numbers could still be fairly big numbers. So we are hopeful that that can materially change the picture, both for the state budget and also for the money that can be made available to cities and towns. There is a lot of attention being paid to state and local government exposures, in part because state and local budget cuts were a significant drag on recovery coming out of the last recession. It sort of took noticeable amounts off of GDP growth coming out of the last recession. I think there's an awareness of that at the federal level and a desire not to repeat that. There's also been a lot of attention at the federal level to the challenges of reopening schools. And so I think we're going to continue to see federal movement on that front. So that's the status, I think, that we, you know, where we plainly have at the state level a significant tax exposure. We equally are likely to have a significant round of additional federal funds, and how those two things match up is what makes it extremely hard to plan for FY21 at this point. We expect to issue a bulletin probably next week, or we intend to issue a bulletin next week that will lay out how we will do local assessments and local aid for July under an interim budget. If we are still under an interim budget in August, essentially the same rules would apply. And essentially what we would do is take FY20 amounts for the various categories of aids and assessments, and you use that, the FY20 divided by 12, to get 1 month's worth as sort of the run rate for both aid and assessment in the summer of 2020. So more to come on that, but that is our expectation for the summer, and that's what we know right now. We are watching the federal situation very closely and working closely with the legislature to figure out next steps on what's been an extremely challenging budget process. I think you're on mute, Jeff.
Sorry about that. There was a car driving by and I muted myself because I didn't want it to appear on the video. The issue is, regarding CARES Act and a couple of other financial questions have come up in the chat. Would it be okay to run those through with you since you have the stage?
Right.
Okay, great. Okay, let's take them in the order in which they came. One was just generally on the budget, the timing of the budget. Your last statement implied that you think that it's likely that the legislature would consider starting the year with a 1/12 budget, waiting for the federal government to give some clarity. Is that where you think things stand now?
That's our expectation. Given that it's now June 16th, I think there's no realistic expectation that we would have a budget that's enacted by the legislature in the next 14 days, given the extraordinary uncertainty. So yes, we expect to operate on an interim budget for July.
Thank you. A few CARES Act questions. First of all, there's a comment. There was only a 10-day turnaround for one community to get their CARES Act reimbursement. So thank you very much and great work there. Well, some kudos. Question about FEMA can take 3 to 4 years to approve funding for events. So what guarantee do we have, the communities have, that CARES funds would be available 4 years from now when FEMA finally awards its funding? How would you account for the 25% CARES Act match for those?
So we're proposing to act on essentially an estimated basis because essentially that's the best we can do. I think that FEMA, right, one of the things that often causes a delay in FEMA is that the event occurs, the application is submitted, FEMA approves the application, but doesn't actually have funds appropriated from Congress, and so therefore can't provide the funding. Right now, FEMA has money because there was about $45 billion that was appropriated for FEMA in the CARES Act. I think we would encourage cities and towns to try to get FEMA applications in as soon as they reasonably can, because I think right now when the money's available, you're likely to see faster turnaround times. But there's no right way around the fact that there are, you know, thousands of entities who are applying for FEMA funding. We can't guarantee that it will move quickly. I mean, we don't run it, but also I think reasonably it's going to take some time. And that's why we have recommended that there was a bulletin that came out of DLS about sort of how to set up a special revenue fund, kind of how to account for expected FEMA reimbursements from a municipal finance perspective. We are going to need to operate on an estimated basis because we really just don't have a better option.
Yeah, Jeff, this is Sean. If I could just add one piece of that.
This is a question maybe for... Go ahead, Sean.
Could you hear me, Jeff?
Yes,
I'm sorry. I'm having some technical difficulties here today with my laptop. So I just wanted to add on to what Catherine said. The bulletin that we sent out about accounting, you know, I think in a nutshell, what folks want to know is this going to impact free cash or deficits that need to be raised in a future levy? The answer is it's going to be treated the same way things were treated back in the winter of 2015 when we had the back-to-back-to-back-to-back snowstorms. And we basically let communities have deficits on their balance sheets until a final FEMA payment was made. And if there was a remaining deficit, they needed to raise that. But free cash wasn't hit until final payments were made. So if it does take 4 years, which we hope it doesn't, there'll be no impact on free cash until everything is finalized.
Great. And Sean Cronin, I think everyone recognizes your voice, but I'll just say who that was. Sean, here's another question for you. Are CARES Act funds considered grant funds? In other words, do we need to get city council approval?
Yes, you got to follow 53A and get city council. And it's treated as a grant. The other option, if it was done a different way, would have been general fund revenue, which would have been even more complicated. But go to council, get the acceptance of it, and then you have your city auditor do the accounting, basically the credits and debits in the different funds that need to happen. It should be all set.
Here's another question. If a request for CARES funds was listed under a particular category in the application, could those funds be used for a different allowed expense?
So yes, is the short answer. I think that we are trying to get an understanding of how funds are being used. And so we would appreciate, as I'm sure you all have, that your application be done to the best of your ability. But we also recognize that things change, circumstances change, actual costs might change some. So through the reporting process that we anticipate, we would ask you to update us as time goes on. But yes, I mean, what we've transferred is an amount that is available for these allowed purposes, and we will be in touch to see how they're in fact being used. Thank you.
Great, thank you. And while it's understandable that long-term capital projects aren't allowable as a use of the funds, here's a question that says, many cities and towns have small office reconstruction projects to ensure social distancing, such as a small wall or so on. Would you consider those to be an appropriate use of CARES funds to retrofit an office so that it can serve the public or municipal employees?
Yeah. So I think no is the short answer. We are wary, as I said, of essentially making long-term capital investments because of the extent to which capital infrastructure investments could end up sort of swamping the program. I would say that this is that as with all of these funds, this is something that we want to keep an open dialogue around. And so if there's enough concern on this topic and we need to revisit this decision, we're willing to have that conversation. But at this point, we have tried to draw the line at capital infrastructure investments.
Thank you. And Catherine, you're called out in this question. This is for you. If the school costs are greater than what's allocated through ESSER, are the costs then eligible through the CARES Act? If so, should the request be submitted equitably via the towns?
So the second part is the easier one. Yes, they should be done through the towns because municipalities are the only eligible subrecipient through this program. The first one, unfortunately, is kind of the harder one, so I'd ask you to stay tuned on that front. We will be working with EOE, we are working with EOE and with DESE to try to get a better handle on what are the likely costs of reopening, what are the likely costs of social distancing in the schools, and what's the best match in terms of costs and revenue sources. So stay tuned on that one. Thank you. Please.
And let me see. Here's a question that was already answered. We could use a couple of server replacements to replace our telework capacity as we continue remote working. Is that an eligible request?
So yes, provided it's directly related to COVID-19. So to the extent that you are adding capacity, say, because you have more people teleworking than before, yes, that's an allowable expense. We do not want to pay for just general maintenance or the sorts of upgrades that you might have been considering all along. So it should be directly related to COVID-19.
Okay, thank you very much, Catherine. I think that is all, and the last one on CARES Act funds, and then we'll go back to the Lieutenant Governor. Can CARES Act funds be used to apply to COVID safety protocol supplies expenses on public building projects currently under construction, such as those funded by, say, MSBA?
I believe, I know we addressed this question and I can't remember the answer. Can we get back to you on that one, please?
Absolutely. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine. I think that we've run through a lot of those, plus some general comment on the timing of the budget, which is that there's still more information and it's a longer process. As you know, obviously, cities and towns are looking for guidance on local aid, but of course, we also want those numbers to be as high as humanly possible. And because they are important to our economy and to serving the public. So it's a delicate balance. I'm going to turn it back now to the Lieutenant Governor, and thank you very much, Catherine.
Catherine, thank you. It was like stump Catherine, very difficult to do. Thank you. I appreciated your ability to say yes, no, bring clarity to these ambiguous areas. And in an uncertain time, the more clarity we can find anywhere is a good thing. I know that Sean Cronin is on, and I know Dr. Larry Madoff is on. Maybe Dr. Madoff, did you have anything you'd like to add to our discussion today?
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. Thanks to all of you for being here today. DPH really values the chance to hear from you and to speak with you. The The good news, I guess, is that our metrics continue to improve, and we're seeing fewer cases, and we are seeing fewer hospitalizations. We're seeing fewer people in the hospital. Our percentage of positive tests also continues to go down in the Commonwealth, and we're really grateful because we know that that reflects an effort on everybody's part to make this happen. And it's gratifying to see things improve and to see the reopening happening, and we're keeping our fingers crossed for continued favorable metrics as we go forward. I know the administration, the governor and lieutenant governor are extremely attentive to those metrics and work with us closely in seeing that happen. And in providing the guidance that's allowed the reopening to happen safely, and we really appreciate that. I was asked to talk a little bit about senior centers. Was one of the issues that I know is of concern, and I can tell you what we know, and I can tell you that there's a lot that we don't know, You know, one of the things that that has been notable throughout this this pandemic and has been as true here in Massachusetts as it has been everywhere in the world is the toll that COVID has taken on older people. And we see that the risk of complications, the risk of hospitalization, and the risk of death in our elders has been so dramatic everywhere, and the risk is clearly the risk to serious complications and bad outcomes with COVID begins to rise even in people in their late 50s, but it really dramatically rises when you get above the age of 65 or so. And indeed, the average age of death in people who've died of COVID in Massachusetts is in the 80s. And so it really has a dramatic impact. And all of the efforts that we're making to flatten the curve, to lower the outbreak, is about protecting those who are most vulnerable and also protecting our healthcare capacity. And the impact of COVID on our seniors is dramatic, both in terms of mortality and also in the impact on the healthcare system, because people who become seriously ill with COVID obviously become hospitalized and end up in intensive care units and sadly succumb and die from COVID. And that's the last thing that we want to see happen. So I just would, with those facts in mind, I just want to look at senior centers, and I know how important senior centers are in our communities. I live around the corner from a senior center, and it saddens me not to see it used as much as it was in these pre-epidemic times. And I very much look forward to the time when we are in a safer time, when we're in the new normal and can see activities there resume at full strength. But I just want to emphasize that these are the folks who are the most vulnerable, both by virtue of age and often because of the comorbidities that come with age, the other diseases, the heart disease, diabetes, liver disease, immunocompromising conditions, and lung disease that are so often accompany aging. And because of those confluence of factors in our seniors, I just want to make sure that we're especially careful in these populations. So to the extent that that these centers begin to reopen as we move into later phases of our reopening process, I just want, you know, these are the places where all of our safeguards are most important: the social distancing, the use of facial coverings, cloth face coverings that governor's order calls for, and hand hygiene and cleaning and all of the measures that we're taking to safeguard, these are all the more important in senior centers. And as we very cautiously approach reopening, these are the kinds of measures that we're going to need to employ. And I think this is going to depend also on where we stand in terms of the outbreak. And when we're pretty sure that community transmission is no longer occurring, then it's a much safer situation than in situations where we are starting to see, when we are seeing community transmission. And so those factors, I think, are going to need to come into play as we look hard at how and when to reopen senior centers. So I realize I'm not giving you a definitive answer on this question, but I think it's something that we're going to need to look at in these very vulnerable populations. And I think I will stop there. I know I want to allow time for questions and for other speakers. So thank you very much.
Jeff, I think you're on mute.
Yeah.
You'd think I hadn't, this isn't our 13th one. You'd think I'd learned how to stop muting and unmuting. So I think it's because the window's open because it's such a beautiful day. But the issue is very difficult for communities because communities want to open their programs, but these are the most vulnerable people. And it's your words of caution I think, taken to heart by every local official. And also, there's no, when these stages come, we'll segue to you now, Lieutenant Governor. Not in the in this phase, I believe, correct?
I didn't exactly hear your question. Are you asking when senior centers could reopen? I think Dr. Madoff articulated an answer that I think most people can understand as we reopen.
Yeah.
We're asking people to adhere to the social guidance around wearing face coverings, social distancing, hand sanitization, and if you have a particular vulnerability due to a health condition, or you are older and have some frailties, that you need to make different decisions. And we also have learned from our public health officials that outdoor is better than indoors. And I think one of the reasons why we're seeing success here in the Commonwealth is because the weather has significantly improved over these past weeks, and there's just a lot more opportunity outdoors. I don't know, Dr. Howe, you would factor in the question on the chat that talks about balancing the physical health of our seniors with their mental health, given the isolation that they've been experiencing over these past months, with opportunities outdoors that might safely resume at some point. As many of you know, when we think about the next phases of recovery and reopening, we look to prepare industry sectors and institutions for what they need to do to get ready. Right now you're seeing, for instance, recreational camps and programs opening outdoors, some youth activities indoors, but we understand that youth are less compromised than adults. So we have not allowed for indoor adult activities in sports facilities, for instance. But I'm wondering, Doctor, if you have any thoughts for our reopening board to consider around outdoor activities for seniors.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor, and I thank you for raising that public health point and about outdoors being safer than indoors. And we see that, again, all over the world, and it may be, you know, as much as a factor of 20-fold safer to have activities outdoors. I think we took advantage of that in allowing for the first time, visitations in skilled nursing facilities that are being conducted outdoors only at this point. And I think that would be a good way of cautiously balancing the needs of seniors for social interaction and psychological needs against the safety by perhaps beginning with outdoor activities. And again, one of the questions in the chat was about, you know, is this going to happen before we have a vaccine or therapeutics? And I think, I think, again, this is it depends on what we see from the outbreak metrics. And I think if we're in a situation where we've largely eliminated transmission of COVID in the communities, then, you know, then that's a very different situation than if there's ongoing transmission. And so I think we're going to need to, very cautiously approach this question. And you know, all of our efforts are towards protecting the most vulnerable. And also, as the Lieutenant Governor said, people using their own judgment in this population about their own vulnerabilities is going to be important also. So I think it's, unfortunately, as I've been saying on a lot of phone calls lately, is stay tuned.
Can you describe for the audience here a little bit about the long-term care outdoor visits, how that's going, how it's organized and structured, and it might be something that we could work on as we prepare for the next phase with the good weather months ahead of us?
Yes, so the outdoor visits in skilled nursing facilities are something that was just started, I can't remember exactly the date, but in the last couple of weeks. And it was, of course, all visitation has been was stopped in the nursing facilities because of the dangerous and deadly outbreaks that we were seeing there. And the idea, with the spring weather that and taking advantage of the improved transmission characteristics that the virus is much less likely to transmit outdoors. We were able to begin cautiously visits in these nursing facilities where residents would come to an outside space that up to two visitors could be in attendance, distanced at 6 feet and with all of the parties wearing face coverings. This was begun. And so far it has been quite successful is my understanding. Many residents have benefited from it. From the interaction, and of course, being able to visit with families and loved ones is so important for the psychological well-being of both parties, the visitors and the residents. So I think we're cautiously optimistic. This is going well, and we have not seen any negative repercussions at this point.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Lieutenant Governor, we have about 8 or 9 minutes left in this session, and there are a number of questions that look ideally suited for you, or you can delegate them to your team. Would you like me to run through those now?
Absolutely, sure. Thank you, Dr. Mayor.
So we'll go, there are a couple on restaurants, and with the move to outdoor dining, can you talk a little bit about the executive order that you issued that does give communities the ability to streamline local permitting processes for restaurants, outdoor dining?
Yes, and so this was an opportunity for restaurants that either have outdoor dining as part of their on-premises consumption and license and maybe wish to expand it, or for restaurants that don't have that capacity and would be able to provide some outdoor dining if they had access to a sidewalk, a bus lane, a parking lot, or parking spaces. And that the order just allowed for the municipality to have more flexibility to expand the on-premises consumption license without having to go through the three-step process with ABCC and to allow that seating to be placed outdoors. And the order does allow for the outdoor seating under the protocol of 6 foot distances between tables, face coverings to be worn by staff and face coverings by patrons as they're coming and going, and then seated. The public health guidance is strong about seated. People need to get to their table and sit. The table can be organized up to six people, and then the table 6 feet apart. That's the same guidance for both indoor and outdoor. It does also allow for a covering over the outdoor dining space. It could be an umbrella, it could be a canopy, it could be a tent, so long as there's ventilation. So I think the wording says somewhere around 50% of a tent needs to have airflow. So think about a tent that has a cover, but also sides. You would want to open these sides so that there was a proper amount of airflow and ventilation. We felt that would be helpful to restaurants as they're investing in this outdoor area and experience with chairs and tables. And we realized that it's a lot of work if you're bringing those tables and chairs into stored areas every night in order to keep that material safe and then have to put it out again for the next day. So that is also allowed in the order. And this grant that I shared with you earlier was intended to complement not only the relief for permitting locally, but also to provide you with some assistance as you're trying to reorganize these outdoor spaces that have to be done with accessibility in mind. If you're taking a sidewalk and now using it for dining, you need to make sure that people with different abilities have the opportunity to get by and be able to establish those safe and accessible passageways is also a part of this. But I have seen great creativity and innovation and a willingness on the local level to be a little bit broader in your thinking around how to accommodate these restaurants. And it appears that the public is responding to that too. I've heard a lot of good stories all across the Commonwealth of people are trying this out and they really enjoy it.
Lieutenant Governor, there are a couple of other follow-up questions. Just one pushing, advocating for the legislation that's pending in the Senate now. It's passed the House that would shorten the two-week public hearing notice requirement that was intended, and then also allow, for example, mixed drinks as takeout during the public emergency and some other aspects. Any insight on the timing of that legislation, and are you receptive to that?
Oh, absolutely. We issued the executive order because we wanted to give you more tools to work with to allow the restaurants to open for outdoor dining, and knowing that it does take some time to process legislation. So when this legislation is passed and reaches us, the order in effect will go away on that provision because the legislation will then be permanent for until a period of time. I think there is a time period that it sunsets. But it also is something that's important to the legislature. I know it originated in the House, and we did discuss this at leadership yesterday, and the Senate president is reviewing that and said that her team has an interest in seeing that bill move forward. I don't have a time commitment from them, but the executive order is pretty expansive to allow you to have the flexibility to process and permit and to work with these establishments.
Thank you, and we appreciate your advocacy and action on both fronts. A question about the shared streets grant and whether that could be utilized to adapt outdoor lots to accommodate senior access. And also, would these funds be limited only to public ways?
All right, so it's allowed for municipalities, sidewalks, curbs, streets, on-street parking spaces, and off-street parking lots in support of public health, safe mobility, and renewed commerce in their communities. So it has a broad latitude I would suggest applying. It is on a rolling basis, and the Barr Foundation is available to you as well to provide the technical assistance to process the application and to design it in a way that will meet your need.
Excellent, thank you. A question about pop-up testing sites. One community just had very, very recently a large demonstration and is wondering whether they would be able to have a pop-up site. I know Candace Pierce from our staff did post for everyone the link to the location of all of those sites. So hopefully there's one nearby in that community. But if protests or demonstrations continue in that, would this be something that you would consider doing again in terms of the pop-up testing?
We'll see what the need is. This obviously was something we identified with our public health officials that we wanted to test further to again give people the comfort and confidence in our data, and the data really drives our decision making in terms of reopening. So we felt that a two-day testing system would be appropriate, much like the city of Boston just conducted. And having 50 sites, these 50 sites are located in places where there was more activity around gatherings. And 50 is a pretty good number, given that these testing sites allow the test to be conducted either by appointment in some locations or by just showing up. And it's free. So we're encouraging people who have been a part of a large gathering and might have an exposure to get tested. And the test result is confidential, and it will inform you about how to either quarantine or isolate or get treatment if needed if you start to feel symptomatic to follow through. These 50 sites are what it is for this week. The future, we'll see what it brings.
Thank you. I'll combine a couple of questions because we only have a minute left regarding what's your thought regarding the time between that will go into the second part of phase two and then potentially phase three?
Okay, so our phased in approach calls for a minimum of 3 weeks in between the start of phases. So that we would like to adhere to, and it's because of a two-week period of time where this virus can be manifested within an individual and then become symptomatic or be potentially someone that could be spreading the virus unknowingly. And that allows the 2 weeks of data collection as well as a week to review. And as we approach the end of this week, we will have a collection of data that we feel will be sufficient enough for us to make a decision around the start of the second level of phase two. If all goes well, and the numbers continue as they are, you would see phase two or phase two begin early next week. And you would place phase three somewhere in the early half of July, somewhere in between the 4th of July and the week following that is what we anticipate the start of phase three being. But as you are aware, as we see more people moving about and more activity because of business openings, work openings at offices and people moving about, we need to monitor the data and determine what impact that is having on any spread of the virus. So we'll continue to monitor that, and we hope that we continue along as we are. And we really appreciate what everybody's doing on their own parts to contribute to the successful progression into these next phases. We continue to meet with industry stakeholders as well, informing us around their readiness, their ability to bring back workforce and prepare their workplace, and want to give people as much notice as possible to get ready for the next phases. It's certainly true not only for business, but for youth sports and other activities that are important. And the one that you raised today around our senior centers is certainly one that we will talk with the public health officials around what is the right way to balance the public health and mental health, and I saw food insecurity needs of our senior populations in our communities.
Thank you. And a question came in regarding how the information is going to be shared with businesses. I think you cover, you and the governor cover this in your updates, your daily updates to the citizens of the Commonwealth. So I think there was just a request that businesses that are in phase three, if it's a later time, then...
I think Mayor Cahill raises, it could be June 29th from a 3-week time period from the beginning of phase two. It could be around that time. It could be a little bit after that. We're really not sure, but I wouldn't, what we've always said, it's not a date, it's the data. And we want to look at the data to determine when to allow more activity. So I wouldn't even put that date down as concrete. It really is the data that drives us. Let's hope that we get to the next phase of phase two, which could be June 22nd, and then we can evaluate where we are for phase three. But it really is the data, and the data so far looks good. This week, having 2 days of testing at 50 pop-up sites will also give us more insight in terms of the presence of the virus in the Commonwealth.
Very good. I think that we're coming up on the very last question. There were a couple that came in where folks were looking for legal advice for their community regarding their own zoning codes and so on. And my recommendation to those communities would be to just consult with your own legal counsel and the experts regarding how your code interacts with these requirements. The last question is something that you may know. Dr. Madoff had to drop off of the call, unfortunately, but regarding workers in a town hall, indoors during the day, if employees are socially distanced, are they required to wear the face mask all day, the face covering?
The guidance from public health is you use a face covering if you are not able to socially distance. If you are, you do not need to wear that. I should also say that outdoors is better than indoors, and you know, ventilation and airflow are also important to take into consideration, but the guidance is not and, it's for.
And I'll just make a note for the MMA's office. Everyone wears a face mask, a face covering all the time, regardless of whether or not the person is 6 feet or 25 feet away. And communities can go stronger in terms of their requirements, correct?
That's right.
I will now turn it over to you, Lieutenant Governor, for the closing words. Any closing thoughts? This has been a very enlightening and well-organized event by your administration. We thank you very much.
Great. We look forward to doing this as long as we need to in terms of addressing these issues. Very important. I would just say, thank you for what you're doing. Encourage your residents to get out and support your local businesses, buy local. Adhere to the guidances, but make good choices and use common sense and try to enjoy the outdoors and some time with your family. And I'm sure that at some point you'll be looking to bring more of your staff back into city halls and town halls and readying your workforce for more in-person services. And we'll be happy to continue to work with you so that you can make good decisions for your own government employees. Thank you for everything. I really appreciated this time today. And if there are items that are still outstanding, we'd be happy to provide you with that information so you can share it with the members. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor. This has been the 13th briefing, weekly briefing by Lieutenant Governor and the Baker-Polito administration to the Municipal Chief Executive Officers of Massachusetts. As usual, an audio recording of this event will be posted on the MMA website. That also will include a summary of this particular briefing and answers to all the questions that were provided. In addition to that, any unanswered questions will be sent to the administration. They answer the ones that they can, and then we provide that information back out to you. And then, of course, we look forward to having you join us all in 1 week, next Tuesday, for the 14th weekly briefing on this pandemic, the emergency. Thank you very much for all that the administration is doing, Lieutenant Governor and your team, and the governor, and of course, to all the local officials in Massachusetts. Thank you and have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you.